And just like that, the actor best known as Mr. Big in the Sex and the City franchise faces two allegations of rape. Chris Noth says the encounters were consensual. And then homeless by choice. Recently, we've seen several young people, even teens, leave home to live on the streets. How this dream life away from home can quickly turn into a nightmare. Plus, the Apple AirTags. They are great for tracking down your keys or wallet, but they're also being used to track down people, and without knowing it, you might be one of them. And I asked, and you answered. We're shining a light on the need-to-know cases not getting enough attention. That is all tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten in tonight for Ashley. Millions have cheered the return to TV of Carrie, Miranda, and Charlotte, and of course, Mr. Big. But for Zoe and Lily, it was just too much. Zoe and Lily are pseudonyms given by The Hollywood Reporter to two women who approach that outlet separately, each unknown to the other, with similar, highly disturbing allegations years apart against Chris Noth, the actor who played Mr. Big. Zoe says Noth raped her in a West Hollywood apartment in 2004 when she was 22 and he was 49. She was new to L.A., working her first job in the entertainment field, and says Noth would chatter up at her desk and leave flirty voicemails on her office phone. She says Noth lured her to his apartment to return a book, and the attack that followed was so rough, she says she needed stitches. She came forward in October, triggered, she says, by publicity for the Sex and the City reboot called And Just Like That. Lily says Noth attacked her in 2015 in New York, where she worked in the VIP room of a nightclub. She was 25, and Noth was then 60 years old. She met him for dinner, after which he brought her to his Greenwich Village apartment, where she says she was totally violated. Lily contacted The Hollywood Reporter in August, and she too says media hype over Noth's reboot of Mr. Big was the reason she came forward. I want to bring in tonight a star-studded panel to talk about all of this, including many of the details I didn't get to yet. Gloria Allred is a lawyer who's fought against sexual abuse, harassment, and discrimination in all of its forms for decades. Roger Neal is the dean of celebrity publicists and PR experts. And Trent Copeland is a criminal defense attorney with a Rolodex full of A-list clients. But before I let any of you weigh in, I first want to read the statement that came out today from Chris Noth. Noth tells The Hollywood Reporter, and I quote here, "The accusations against me made by individuals I met years, even decades ago, are categorically false. These stories could have been from 30 years ago or 30 days ago. No always means no. That is a line I did not cross. The encounters were consensual. It is difficult not to question the timing of these stories coming out. I don't know for certain why they are surfacing now, but I do know this. I did not assault these women." Okay, so Gloria, I want to start with you. Noth doesn't deny the encounters, but he says that they were consensual. How do you think that these women can prove otherwise?
Well, I mean, the question is it their burden to prove that they did not consent? Is it his burden to prove that they did consent? This is in the court of public opinion, so people are going to believe whatever they want to believe. There's no standard of proof. There's no burden of proof. There's no jury except in the court of public opinion. So people will, you know, reach their own conclusions. It's going to be interesting to see also if there are other women who come forward in addition to these two. That often happens when two women decide that they're going to be public. Others often who have never told anyone or maybe only told close friends or family members, they often come forward as well.
Trent, let me ask you, because just in the last couple of minutes, LAPD confirmed to us that there is no investigation at this time and there is no official police report at this time. What do you make of that?
Well, I think Laura's right. This is in the court of public opinion, and what you're getting from the LAPD is confirmation of that. This is just in the court of public opinion. There's not a criminal investigation. And part of the reason for that here in LA, in Los Angeles, Brian, is because the statute of limitations has run on that case in 2004. Remember, statute of limitations in California with respect to sexual assault, rape allegations, those claims, is just 10 years. So this is long past that statute of limitations. That does not mean that the statute of limitations in New York has not run, because that statute of limitations is 20 years. So Mr. Nauth is still in peril if there's an investigation ongoing in New York as a result of the allegations there. But in terms of what LAPD is doing, it probably isn't going to go anywhere. And I think Gloria's right. This will probably simply remain in the court of public opinion for Los Angeles. But if there are other new women who come out as a result of having heard these allegations, and those allegations took place in California within the last 10 years, then Mr. Nauth could still be in legal jeopardy in California as well.
And Trent, some of these allegations, 17 years old, all of this time has passed by. No investigation right now, according to LAPD, but if they do open one, how difficult is this to investigate? I mean, do you need DNA at this point?
You don't need DNA. Remember, Brian, this case isn't any different than the Harvey Weinstein investigation, those cases with Bill Cosby, R. Kelly, Kevin Spacey. Those cases move forward. There were criminal investigations, civil investigations associated with it, and you don't always need DNA. DNA would be great to have, but you don't always get it. And typically, you don't with the passage of time, because not every victim goes to the hospital, not every victim saves a dress or something that has DNA on it. But sometimes it's corroborated by statements they made to people immediately thereafter. And in both of these instances, remember, Brian, both of these instances, these women went back and immediately made what's referred to as outcries. They went and they told people close to them what happened. And one, in fact, even went and received medical care and treatment. So, you know, there appears to be corroborating evidence that would circumstantially support their claims.
And Roger, let me bring you in, because both Trent and Gloria, they're both talking a lot about the court of public opinion. And mm-hmm. I know that is your realm. Yeah. And Chris Nauth is much bigger than just Sex and the City. I mean, he was on The Equalizer, Law and mm-hmm. Order. You know, he's a big celebrity. What does this mean for him?
Well, Brian, thanks for having me on tonight. He's got a real nightmare on his hand, I have to tell you, and he's going to have to be very careful how he handles this and how he proceeds. He has denied the allegations. He says it's consensual. Okay, now time will tell and bear out if that's going to be true or not. But in the court of public opinion, he's really got to walk a fine line. He's got to listen to his team, or he's in real trouble. Peloton already pulled the ad today that he was in. This is a ripple effect. A lot of people are going to be affected by this. So he really has to be careful what he does, or it could really hurt his career. I mean, this is a major thing. This is not a small thing at all. And I really think he's got to really listen to his team, listen to his attorney, listen to his publicist. This could affect his career in a major way. So I would say that he needs to be very careful about what he does next.
And he's also he's also asking in his statement, which you read, that, you know, why now? Why are women coming forward now? Well, they answered it. It's because the fact that there's so much coverage of essentially the reboot of Sex and the City, it's triggering for them to see him on the screen. I've represented literally thousands of rape and sexual assault as survivors and victims and fighters for change. And I've heard that many times over the years, that suddenly they see this person in a movie, on television, and they've tried to kind of press it down inside themselves, the memory of what happened to them. And now literally it triggers all of that memory that they've been suppressing to come up and bubble up. And then they decide, you know what? I've suffered in silence. I want to say something about this particular person. So there are lots of reasons people don't go to the police. And a matter of fact, Dr. Ziv, who was the expert on rape, who testified in both the Bill Cosby criminal case and the Harvey Weinstein criminal case, testified that most women who were raped or sexually assaulted never go to the police. And the fact that they don't doesn't mean that they were not raped or sexually assaulted, or that they were. It just doesn't happen.
Let me just quickly jump in there really quickly.
And
Brian,
Roger, Gloria, go ahead, Trent. Yeah, sure.
I was just going to say, it is still a fair question, though, Gloria. You would agree that it is, you know, conspicuously interesting that the reboot would be the triggering event mm-hmm. for this. Now, he's been on the news. He's been in The Equalizer. He's been on television for a lot of years. And surprising that this would be the instance and this would be the time when they would choose to make that statement. I'm going to take a side here, but I do think it's interesting. And I think it's a fair question for Chris Noth and his team to ask. And that is, why now?
Why not now?
And Roger, we're talking about this statement a lot, the way that he mm-hmm. worded it. And I know, Roger, in what you do, you have helped celebrities craft statements just like yes. this. What do you make of the statement? I mean, do you think it strikes the right tone?
I think that he's doing what he has to do to cover himself right now. I believe that there's goodwill right now towards him as far as, hey, it's consensual. I didn't force myself on these women. This is what he's saying basically in the statement. So I think if he really wants to clear himself or he wants to have the public opinion on his side, he's going to have to figure out how to do a live interview and answer some hard questions and make it live on television so it can't be edited and answer some questions and be honest with America. America's people are forgiving if you're honest with them, but he's got to be very careful what he does from this point on or it could really backfire in a very big way. But the statement, I thought they did a very good job on the statement today.
Yeah, R. Kelly didn't do very
one
well
thing
when
Trent
he was interviewed
think-
by Gayle King.
Right. Yeah. I don't think anyone's arguing that. Trent, one thing that I think is interesting is that these women talked to people when this happened. And there are basically witnesses that they spoke to. That's got to sort of help them legally.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we said it a moment ago, Brian, that, you know, who you go to immediately after the event is very important. And Gloria knows this, I think, better than anyone on this panel, that, you know, what you do immediately after such a traumatic event says a lot about the narrative of the story in terms of how that will be told to law enforcement. If you go to law enforcement, if you go to a friend, if you go to your mother, you go to a parent, you go to a spouse, and you immediately tell the story, that story is then corroborated by that person in real time at that moment, rather than waiting weeks, months, or even years to tell the story. And in both of these instances, both of these women went and they told people, and those people remember the stories, and those people will also serve as witnesses as to what they were told at or around the time of the incident. And I think it bolsters their story, gives credibility to the story, and it really strengthens the story going forward.
And let's talk about why women don't report to the police or don't necessarily go to civil lawyers in the first place, because most women don't know any lawyer that they're going to go to, or they think they can't afford it. And they think also that if they go to the police, they won't be believed, that maybe they're the only one who is making a complaint against a rich, famous, powerful person. And they also fear often that there'll be repercussions for their own careers if they speak out, or that something bad will happen to members of their family. Women have a lot of fear, and fear, of course, is the weapon that keeps women silent, keeps women subordinated, and keeps women as prey for sexual predators. Now, I'm not saying Chris is one of them. He may or may not be, but I'm saying that there are lots of reasons why even women who have been raped don't necessarily report right away. The same is true for victims of child sexual abuse, by the way.
Let me ask you this, Gloria, and I apologize. There's a weird delay on my end tonight, so I don't mean to keep cutting you all off. But, Gloria, one thing that I struggle with in these situations when they come up, and again with Chris Noth, is, you know, obviously I want to believe the women and take what they say seriously, but I also struggle with just writing people off based on one report. I mean, how do you handle that?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by one report. They're two persons who allege they are victims here. And as I said,
I meant one article. I'm sorry, the one article that came out.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, again, you know, I don't represent either one of these two accusers, so I'm not in a position to say how strong a case they have. But, you know, when people live with something within them, an injustice that they feel rage about because they feel that they were powerless at the time, or that, you know, and that there's nothing they can do about it, you know, suddenly, you know, at some point, you know, they just burst out and they get that rage comes out and they decide, you know, he shouldn't be able to get away with it. He, you know, he needs to be accountable. He's never been accountable. And I'm, what am I, just like a used Coke can that is thrown out of a window as the car is speeding down the highway? I'm a human being. I have feelings. I should be respected. And, you know, again, people will judge their credibility when they, if they do, give interviews in a court of public opinion. It's a scary thing, I'm sure, for them. And they may be in fear as well at this point. And so we'll have to wait and see. He's got a whole team of people, an entourage, public relations people, all the other people that Roger described. Who do they have? This first foray, perhaps, into the public realm. And I'm sure that they're still in fear right now, but there are lots of people who are who would be willing to support them if they just reached out.
And Trent, in many of these situations, lawsuits follow. At this point, we don't know that there are any lawsuits filed at this point, but do you expect that to happen?
I think it's a little difficult at this point to predict, Brian. My sense is that the lawsuits will likely not follow. Because, again, in the same way that there are statute of limitations associated with criminal claims, there's statute of limitations associated with civil claims as well. So I'm not sure, although the burden of proof is less, it's preponderance of the evidence in a civil court as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt where you have to prove a little more. I'm not sure that these women want to go through this. And I think Gloria will also be able to, you know, speak to this. The issue of whether or not they want to relitigate these issues that they've tried to suppress for so long may not be what they're looking for. It may not be that they're looking for money damages. It may not be that they're looking for more added attention. It may simply be they're looking for accountability. But I think from a civil perspective, he's probably less likely to be in the crosshairs than he is in a criminal perspective, particularly with respect to the case in New York, where I think there's really going to be a ratcheted up investigation. And if those claims can be corroborated, then I think we'll have a real issue. And if he's convicted, Brian, in New York, then the civil claim may follow because she doesn't have to produce much other than the receipts that come from that criminal case.
And, you know, often victims or
Roger,
people who feel they're victims,
ahead,
you know,
Gloria.
they're tired of being shamed and blamed. Mm-hmm. And now they feel often that it's the person who they believe has victimized them who should be shamed and blamed. And apparently that's what's happening here.
Roger, right now, two women have come forward. I mean, if more women start speaking out, I would imagine that is not good for Chris Noth.
No, it's not. And the thing that is hurting him right now is these two women we've read and been told do not know each other. And they have similar stories, a similar thing that's happened to both of them sexually by Chris. So that's a real problem for him. He's got a real nightmare on his hand, and he better handle it just right or it could really hurt him in the long run. If more women come forward, he's got some real problems.
That's true.
Okay, Gloria Allred, I know you have to leave us right now, so thank you. Thank you for coming on. Roger and Trent, stay put. Stay right there. I want to turn now to a different story, a big development in the Astroworld Festival tragedy. You might remember, I think we all remember, 10 people died after the crowd surged forward at a Travis Scott concert in Houston on November 5th. The youngest victim was just 9 years old. Well, today, this afternoon, the medical examiner ruled that all 10 victims died of compression asphyxia, also known as chest compression. They were essentially squeezed to death. So I want to start with you on this, Trent. We know there are these ongoing criminal and civil investigations. I covered this. I was in Houston for a week. When I was there, Trent, so many people were saying to me, oh, let's wait for the medical examiner report. For all we know, these people were on drugs. There might be other things involved. Well, now we know they didn't die from drugs. They died because they were stomped and they were they didn't get air. How does that impact these investigations?
Well, it doesn't allow the defendants, it doesn't allow Travis Scott, doesn't allow Astroworld, doesn't allow the organizers of the concert to lean back into the issue of the fact that there may have been a superseding, intervening event, like drug use, like the voluntary ingestion of drugs that led to an overdose, like the ingestion of a narcotic that might have caused you to engage in sort of reckless behavior and cause your own death. That's now off the table. It isn't an intervening factor. It wasn't a superseding event. It is part and parcel of this whole narrative is that alone, Travis Scott, the Astroworld protesters, the Astroworld promoters, were responsible for this event and responsible for the stampede, the cascade of people falling all over each other and literally dying as a result of being stomped to death. That's been eliminated now. There's no defense as to whether or not these people contributed in any material way to their own death. And this is not good news for the people who believe that there was somehow going to be a defense here.
And I'll tell you, when I was in Houston, this is something that bothered the families that I interviewed, that people were accusing their loved ones of being on drugs and sort of trying to blame them. So this is obviously validation now for these families that it was not drugs that killed their loved ones. Travis Scott gave an interview to the Breakfast Club. It's really the one time he's spoken out since the incident. Let's listen to part of what he had to say, and I want to get both of your reactions on the other side.
Yeah, people said they collectively heard folks screaming help every time you stopped the song to get your attention. Did you hear any of those screams?
Nah, man. And you know, it's so crazy because I'm that artist too. Like, you know, anytime you can hear something like that, you want to stop the show. You want to make sure, you know, fans get the proper attention they need, you know? And anytime I could see anything like that, I did, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I stopped like a couple times to just make sure everybody was okay. And I just really just go off the fans' energy as a collective, mm-hmm. you know, call and response. And I just didn't hear that.
I want to start with you, Roger. What mm-hmm. did you make of this interview? Do you think this helps or hurts Travis Scott?
It hurts him. I give him a D for this interview. He contradicted himself in the interview. He first said he heard this people yelling for help after he stopped a song, but he kept performing. Well, who does that? That's crazy. His PR people should have pulled him from the stage. Security should have pulled him from the stage. They should have stopped this show. And, you know, there's a whole lot of failure here on a whole lot of levels, but he definitely did not do himself any good from a PR standpoint with this interview today. I give him a big D for it. He should have been counseled a lot better. He's got the Kardashian dynasty behind him. He should have, you know, they should have worked with him before they put him out there to do an interview. But he just made it look like that he really didn't care that much, which is really not good for him.
And Trent, now that we know that the people did indeed die from being trampled and not being able to breathe, and you also saw that interview where he says he didn't know what was going on, what do you think comes next legally? I mean, could he actually be criminally charged?
It's conceivable, Brian, that he could be criminally charged if there is a direct nexus between some kind of conduct that was negligent or reckless or showed a criminal disregard for human life. And maybe that's what Rogers is alluding to when he indicated that Travis Scott sounded like in that interview that he just didn't care. I'm not sure that I'd be quite as critical as that. You know, I think, look, we've all been to concerts and they're really, really loud. People are really boisterous. It's almost impossible to tell what people are saying. People are singing along to the music. There's percussions, there's music, there's drums, there's instrumentals. There's a lot going on and people are screaming. So I don't give Travis Scott much blame in terms of not knowing with the thousands and thousands of people there that he couldn't hear a scream of help or a series of screams of help. I'm not sure, but I do know that if he, Travis Scott, as a promoter, gave these people what was essentially a key to those grounds, to overrun those grounds, mm-hmm. to come in and to stampede that area with so many people mm-hmm. in such a small, condensed area, yeah. then that can be exposure for Travis Scott. Mm-hmm. That could be where he is somehow having an issue with law enforcement and maybe even a criminal inquiry.
Yeah, very interesting. And Roger, yeah. One thing just covering this story that I've noticed, especially on yeah. social media, is you've got people that love Travis Scott despite this, and then you've got people that really, really hate Travis Scott right now. What do you think comes next for him? I mean, can he actually rebuild his career to where it was?
Well, you know, the public is, you know, very forgiving, but this is a tragic thing. I mean, I think he really needs to work and do something. He needs to, you know, whether it's donate some money to the victims' families. I mean, he needs to really make a major gesture here to show that he's sorry for what has happened. And that will go a long way for him. I just think he really has to do something in a very big way to try to correct this, that something like this would never happen again.
Okay, thank you, Trent Copeland and Roger Neal. Both of you have such great insight, and I really appreciate you coming on tonight.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good night. Okay. Today, I asked Twitter what cases they wanted to see covered. All of my followers, an overwhelming number of you were so fixated, and so was I, on this scary, just disturbing story out of Charlotte, North Carolina. A doorbell camera caught an apparent kidnapping underway, and the video was so hard to watch. The video showed an unknown individual banging on a door, begging for help before being pulled down from behind and dragged away to a waiting car. Charlotte authorities asked the public to help them identify the individuals. So this is the latest as of tonight. Officials found the vehicle seen in the video and located both the victim and the suspect. So that is very good news. That suspect has been identified as 32-year-old Louis Lamontrez Meadows. He was arrested on the spot for an unrelated warrant, and he will be charged with first-degree kidnapping and assault on a female. Police say the victim in this violent kidnapping has been taken to a safe location. Thank goodness. We are not identifying her because she is a victim of domestic abuse. So we will not be doing that. We will continue to follow this and keep you updated as we hear more, because that video is just so, so awful. That's really not the only story you said you wanted to hear about tonight. A lot more that you messaged me and commented today. So stick around. We will dive in together later in the show. Also coming up next, homeless by choice. Teens opting to live on the streets rather than staying at home. Why would they do that? I'll talk to a woman who gave up her home to live in her car. She's going to tell us how it turned out. That's coming up when we come back. Welcome back to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten in for Ashley tonight. Homeless by choice. It's a phrase that's difficult to wrap your head around. Why would anyone give up the comforts of a home to live in for a car or shelter on the street? Why would they do that on purpose? The majority of them are fleeing a desperate situation, and they feel that even a life with no shelter would be better than the home they're living in. But there are some who are looking for a change and desire to start over on their own. Some of those people are young, even teenagers. Recently, two 15-year-olds ran away from their suburban homes to New York City with just $1,200 between them and no real plan. In another case, a 20-year-old from Indiana traveled to San Diego to be with her boyfriend, who had recently been released from rehab. We don't know everything about those two stories or what prompted their departures, but all three of them were found living on the streets. Is it that some young people have a romantic idea about what life without a home is really like? When we come back, I'm going to talk to someone who knows all about this subject. She threw caution to the wind. She gave up her home and she lived in a car in a tent. I'll ask her why on earth she did it, how she did it, and what she thinks about kids who want to do the very same thing. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten in for Ashley tonight. Recently, we've covered several stories about young people, even some teenagers, running away from home with no real plan. Two 15-year-olds ran away to New York City with just $1,200 between them, and a 20-year-old from Indiana ended up living on the streets with her boyfriend. We don't know all the details of exactly why they ran away, but it does appear they were trying to start a new life without a home. I want to bring in someone who also made the decision to be homeless, made the decision to get her perspective on just how difficult it is to make that decision. Kristen Haynes, she is a writer and founder of the blog thewaywardhome.com. She wrote this article right here for Marie Claire. It's called I Became Homeless on Purpose. This is just fascinating to me. You know, Kristen, there are more than 550,000 homeless people in America right now. Most of them did not choose to be there. They live very, very difficult lives. Tell me, why did you decide to give up your home?
Yeah, so I decided to do this when I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is incredibly expensive. And I knew there was no way I could get ahead while paying rent and at my current salary. So I decided I'll just, you know, live in a car, live in a tent for a while, and that'll help me pay off debt, save up money, and become financially secure, because so many young people these days are having a really hard time, you know, saving money and becoming secure. So that was the big impetus as to why I lived in the car and in the tent.
Yeah, and I've got friends all over the country, Kristen, who, you know, they're not even young, but just the price of housing and rentals is insane in cities throughout America. One of my friends, his rent's being raised by $1,000. He just can't afford it anymore. But it doesn't seem like you suggest, though, like giving up a house, do you? I mean, it sounds like it was a really hard life.
Yeah, you know, it was hard at first. The main hard parts for me were getting used to not having all the amenities I was really used to. I think we take for granted having, you know, a fridge, a bathtub, a shower, laundry, like all these things I realized that I used to take for granted, because when I started living in the car, oh, I missed those things a lot. And it was just, you know, being in a home, you have the security of those four walls around you. You know, you're protected from the outside to some degree. But when you're in a tent, especially, and this really made me feel for, you know, homeless people that are not doing this by choice across the country, that living in a tent can be scary. I mean, I did it in campgrounds, but on the street, that would be truly frightening. And it did take me a long time to adjust to being in a vehicle. And in a vehicle, you're also subject to knocks from police or security guards. So your safety net is ripped away. And for me, that was the hardest part at first, was getting used to that.
And what were your days like? I was reading the article. It was so interesting to me that, you know, you have a normal job and that you really used the gym as a place to shower and sort of get yourself together every day.
Yeah, that's correct. I had a normal job in San Francisco that I would commute to every day. And this was back in 2016, back when hardly anyone was doing the van life or living in vehicles. You hear about it a lot more now. But back then, I was so shy to admit that I was doing that, that I have like no photos of it. And I didn't tell anybody at my work. And I would go to the gym every day and take my shower, use the Wi-Fi, have some coffee, get dressed up. And I would wear my, you know, business casual outfit to work. And nobody was the wiser except for a couple coworkers, I told. But that's changed now that it's become more accepted. I have, you know, no qualms about talking about my current lifestyle. But back then it was really challenging, and maintaining that veneer of working in the city every day.
So did it pay off? I know you were trying to save money. I mean, was it worth it? And do you actually, you know, suggest that other teens should do this?
Yeah, I definitely do not suggest that teenagers should do this. I think that if you are an adult and you love adventure, you love freedom, I think you have to love being in nature. You have to love backpacking and uncertainty. And adults that do have some sort of income source or do have, you know, a nest egg, they could try it. I know a lot of people don't have that choice of saving money or even having remote work. But it is hard. You know, it is a lot easier if you do have money and you have a way to make money on the road. And to me, it's definitely worth it. Now that I've done it for so many years, I really can't imagine going into a house. And now it feels opposite. When I go into a house, I just can't wait to get back into my van again. And that's kind of a funny shift that's happened to me over the years.
Yeah, I'm noticing right now, you're in the van right now. So is this where you're living right now, this van that you're in?
It is. Yeah, this is my newest van. I started in the Prius and then went to a Chevy Astro, which is a minivan, and was living out of that for many years. And now I just upgraded to a larger van that I can actually stand up in. And it feels gigantic until I go into a house and I'm like, oh, my van is actually very small. But you do a whole perspective change with living this way. That's actually kind of funny to see throughout the years.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Certainly an adventure. Thank you so much for the insight into it, Kristen. We appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Have a good night, Kristen. Thank you.
You
this is important. If you are under 18 and in a difficult living situation and you just want someone to talk to, and there are so many people like that out there, there is a phone number that you can call. It is 1-800-4-A-CHILD. It is completely anonymous, and someone is there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They can even offer help in over 170 different languages. Again, the number 1-800-4-A-CHILD. And coming up next, Apple has figured out a way for you to never lose track of your keys or your wallet. But there are some creeps out there that are using that to keep tabs on you. And the law might be on their side. Apple AirTags. If you are unfamiliar with what they do, very simply put, like most Apple products, they make your life easier. You attach the checker-sized disc to things that you're constantly misplacing, your keys or your wallet or anything like that, and then you can simply track their locations on your phone. But what if you are the object being tracked? More and more people are finding unwanted AirTags that have been placed on their cars. And at this point, police don't really know what to do about it. Take a look at this.
This is my first instance of running into something like this.
It's literally been like tracking her car. Apparently, it can detect it for whatever reason.
Yeah, how does your phone pick it up?
And here is the kicker. Because the technology is so new, the law has not caught up to it. So this digital stalking, it is not even illegal. We reached out to Apple for comment on all of this. This is what they told us. We take customer safety very seriously and are committed to AirTag's privacy and security. AirTag is designed with a set of proactive features to discourage unwanted tracking, a first in the industry, and the Find My network includes a smart, tunable system with deterrence that applies to AirTag as well as third-party products. Part of the Find My Network accessory program, they call it. We are raising the bar on privacy for our users and the industry and hope others will follow. Joining us now is veteran criminal defense attorney Mark Eiglarsh, whose firm can be found at speaktomark.com. Okay, so that was a nicely crafted statement, Mark, but look, I think it's creepy. And how is it possible that this is not illegal?
Okay, because first, as you said, you know, the legislators have not made any laws that make it unlawful. But let me make the defense of those who are saying it shouldn't be unlawful. There has been a device for hundreds of years, even before this tracking device, that can be used for the same purpose for the most part. And it's round, just like that tracking device. They're called eyes. And there have been people who've been following others for hundreds of years. It's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as a journalist, look, I follow people. I mean, if you followed any of my stories, that's what I do sometimes to get information. I follow people around. But I've never thought of putting a tracker on someone's car. I mean, you're telling me you could put one of these on someone's car, track them, and that is not against the law?
That's correct. Listen, it's a gross violation of privacy, I would say, as a human being. As a lawyer, I would say there's nothing that makes it unlawful. Now, there are people screaming at the screen like, yeah, but it's stalking. Well, no, it's tracking. Stalking is when someone knows about it. They feel harassed. There's got to be something more than simply putting the tracking device on. But let me just say this. What roofies do for rapists, this tracking device does for stalkers. It makes it easier for them to carry out their offenses.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that, Mark. So if you've got a stalker using this to stalk you and something very bad happens to you, you know, is Apple going to be partly responsible for this? Would they be like civilly or criminally liable?
They will 100% be listed in the complaint. They would take their deep pockets and bring them to the table and say, it was so reasonably foreseeable. Banfield did a story about it. Others are telling you that this can be used for a nefarious purpose, and you chose to keep it in the market because you're selling tons of them. So, yes, I think they'll be brought to the table.
And just real quick, we only have a few seconds left. Do you think there will be a law in the future? I mean, do you think the laws are going to catch up to this?
Only if there's a huge crime that is abhorrent that touches a legislator who will then say, you know what? It should be unlawful for a person to put a tracking device on someone else's vehicle without their consent. Seems reasonable.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for coming on the show tonight. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can find Mark's firm online, speaktomark.com. Okay, still to come tonight, I asked you and you answered what stories you thought needed to be told that are not out there, important stories. We're going to get to them coming up next. When I put on Twitter that I would be filling in tonight, many of you messaged me wanting to get the word out about some less publicized missing cases. So here are a few. Please look and listen carefully to these in case you might recognize one of these people. 43-year-old Tamara Lynn Banks, who goes by Tammy. She's been missing since mid-November. She was in the process of moving to Texas from Oklahoma, went to pick up her horses, and vanished. Her family says she would have never abandoned her animals. Anyone with information on her disappearance should contact OSBI at 1-800-522-8017. Dane Elkins, a college student and 23-time racquetball champion, has been missing since December 21st of last year. The University of Santa Cruz engineering student's car was found abandoned, and his phone, computer, and other belongings were found inside the car. The photo in the middle of the image you are seeing was his most recent photo before he disappeared. If you have information, please call LAPD's Missing Persons Unit. The number 213-996-1800. Brendan Santo, he is an 18-year-old student at Grand Valley State University. Missing tonight, he had traveled to East Lansing to spend time with friends the weekend of the University of Michigan-Michigan State game. He was last seen leaving a dorm, but the surveillance cameras weren't working. If you have any info, please contact MSU Police. The tip line, it's 844-996-7873. Madeline Allen, she has been missing since Monday night this week, Snow College, Utah. That's where this happened. According to security cameras, someone believed to be the missing student is shown leaving with a plastic bag and wearing a white fleece jacket. Her friends say it is totally unlike her to just disappear, especially during finals week. If you have information, call Snow College Campus Police, 435-283-7170. And let's get to this last one. 5-year-old Dulce Maria Alvarez. She vanished from Bridgetown City Park, New Jersey, during a visit with her family back on September 16th, 2019. Police think she may have been abducted. This is a picture of what she might look like. If you have info, call police right away. Thank you, Ashley, for letting me fill in. Everybody, have a wonderful night.